the jazzy rhythms of Luther had been lost, and it's these slow, ponderous versions that Bach inherited.
You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
How has the music of J.S. Bach influenced our present-day church music? We'll talk about it during Bach Week in just a moment.
Today's episode of The Coffee Hour is underwritten in part by Concordia University, Nebraska. You can learn more about Concordia University, Nebraska at cune.edu. And that's where we're going today, too.
That is where we're going today. Dr. Joseph Hurl is joining us, professor of music at Concordia University, Nebraska. Welcome back to The Coffee Hour, Dr. Hurl.
Thanks so much. It's fun to be with you.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. I know you know a lot about music and church music and J.S. Bach, and we could probably talk for an entire day about this topic, but we will.
We made it a week, though.
We did make it a week. We'll confine this to 25 minutes for the sake of our podcast listeners. But before we talk about music in our own churches today, I'm curious about your history with J.S. Bach. Who introduced you to the works of J.S. Bach?
I'm not sure I remember.
That's fair.
I do remember. No, okay. When I was in college, my freshman year at Concordia in Bronxville, New York, we did Bach's Cantata 79, Gott der Herr ist Sonne und Schild, God the Lord is Sun and Shield. Mm. And we performed that. I'd never heard of a Bach cantata before. I had no idea what it was. But I was playing, not many people know this, but when I was in college, I was a percussionist, and I was playing the timpani in that performance. And I had a most memorable moment because we were playing in the front of the church there across the street from campus, and one of the timpani mallets slipped out of my hand, flew across the room, and landed in the lap of the college president's wife.
Oh, no. That's a story.
I mean, we love to tell stories. That's a great one, though. I love it. I love it. How would you say J.S. Bach has shaped your relationship with music?
Well, what I admire most about Bach is that he really cared about the music he produced. Every single work shows evidence that he thought this through. He was thoroughly familiar with how to write music, how to shape music, how to get the most out of music. And that has been an incredible lesson for me and one that I try to pass along to my students. You've got to know the craft of music. And if you know the craft of music, that frees you up to be creative with it.
What did people think of Bach's music during his time?
That depends on whom you ask.
I would love to know the opinions.
there were some people who certainly appreciated it. But, you know, in Leipzig, during his tenure there, he was writing, a 20 to 30 minute cantata for performance every week. During his first 5 years in Leipzig, he wrote one of those for every Sunday in the church year and for holy days, except for Sundays during Advent and Lent, because they were penitential seasons. So, as you can imagine, he was insanely busy. And what was really interesting is that he tied those cantatas directly to the gospel for the day. The gospel for the day was also, without exception, the basis for the sermon for the day. So, in essence, these cantatas served as devotional commentaries on the gospel and the sermon. Where was I going with this?
We're talking about why his music and his work was...
Oh, what people thought of it.
As much.
Yeah, yeah.
What people thought of it. Well, some people appreciated that, but there are some books that were written for people to take to church with them, basically devotional books that were intended for the people to use during the lengthy church service. Now, the service lasted 3 hours back then. If communion went long, it could last, up to 5 hours. And the sermon itself occupied the middle hour. It's really interesting reading these books. One of them was published in 1710, and it gives very specific explanations of what's happening in the service. For example, it will say the priest mounts the pulpit at 8 o'clock. The service had started at 7 o'clock. The priest mounts the pulpit at 8 o'clock and finishes his sermon at 9 o'clock or shortly thereafter.
Okay.
Anyway, so these cantatas were performed generally before the sermon. If they were long, they might be split between before the sermon and after the sermon. And some people seem to appreciate that, but generally the expectation was that during the performance of these, people would be reading in their devotional books rather than paying attention to the music. There were also criticisms, both in Leipzig and in other places, about such music because it was written not in the more churchly motet style of ages past, but in the more secular style that had been imported from Italy and used in operas. And so the criticism was these cantatas sounded just like operas, and therefore they were not proper church music. So there was certainly some criticism of those. You know, you ask what people thought of this music. By and large, though, there wasn't a lot of reaction to Bach's music in particular, because his music was not terribly well known outside the places where he was employed, because most of his music was not published during his lifetime.
You mentioned that typically the first hour of the service, that might be 3 to 5 hours long, would likely be the cantata. And we know that Bach is writing this music for each Sunday, each part of the church year. What do we know about the people who are singing it? And the I mean, if they're singing a cantata that frequently, like an hour long, or, you know, an hour's worth of music, what do we know about the folks? Do we have any history from the people who were, like, part of the choir, the musicians who were singing Bach at that time, compared to what do musicians think about Bach today? Like, what were the musicians? Do we have any, like, insights on that? And what was happening with the musicians who were singing the pieces that Bach was writing, that Cantor Bach was writing?
Sure, absolutely. Now, the cantatas themselves weren't that long. Most of the first hour was taken up with the opening liturgy for the service. And so the cantata really lasted only maybe 20, 25 minutes or so. The singers, there has been a debate on how many singers there were in the choir. I tend to believe it was probably a smaller group. But the soprano line was sung by boys from the local Latin school, the St. Thomas School. And they were specially trained for that. And the lower voices were sung by generally young men whose voices had changed and who were now singing alto, tenor, and bass. And then the instrumental parts, the cantatas were accompanied by instruments, were played by essentially volunteer students from the university. Bach tried for years to get the Leipzig City Council to shell out some money so he could hire good instrumentalists, but they never relented. Bach had constant battles with the council to fund the church music program adequately, and the council simply didn't want to do that. And so Bach had to make do with what he had. And so if you wondered about Bach's influence on today's church music, I think that may have been one, because that is something that church musicians often face today, no?
Yeah.
Some things never change, yes.
Some things never change. That is very true. That is not a point I had considered, but yeah, you're right about that. You've mentioned that people didn't really pay attention to his music. His music wasn't really published during his lifetime. So how did Bach's music become famous to like the level that we all know him today. How did that happen after his lifetime?
Well, Bach had one very fortuitous circumstance. He was pretty prolific. He had a lot of children. He had 20 children.
Yeah.
7 by his first wife, and then she died, and then 13 by his second wife. And they appreciated Bach's music, and they helped to disseminate it. It helped that several of his sons became well-known musicians themselves. But the event that even with that, Bach's music was largely forgotten after his death, except for this small circle of his relatives and former students who kind of kept it alive. And when Felix Mendelssohn was growing up in the early 1800s, when he was 15 years old, his grandmother gave him a manuscript of Bach's St. Matthew Passion. And Mendelssohn was absolutely fascinated by it. And he took it to his music teacher, a man by the name of Zelter in Berlin, and said, "This is great." You know, Zelter directed a choir in Berlin called the Zing Academy. And Mendelssohn tried to talk Zelter into doing this with his choir. And finally, Zelter said, "Well, I don't want to be responsible for this, but if you want to conduct the choir in it, you can." So by this time, Mendelssohn was 19 going on 20. And when he was 20 years old, he conducted the Berlin Zing Academy in a performance of Bach's St. Matthew Passion. And that concert attracted he did it from memory, and the choir was really impressed, and everybody connected with it spread word that this is going to be a special performance. So it attracted a lot of important people. And essentially, from this one event, that jump-started the great Bach revival of the 19th century.
And we'll talk more about that in just a moment after we take a quick break. We're talking about Bach's influence on modern-day church music with Dr. Joseph Hurl, Professor of Music at Concordia University, Nebraska. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
At Concordia University, Nebraska, discover a distinctly Christian community that equips students to live by faith with courage, character, and conviction. Intentionally combining our Christian faith, Lutheran heritage, rigorous academics, and practical real-life experiences, we prepare students to fulfill a higher purpose in their vocations and life. Learn more about Concordia University, Nebraska at our website, cune.edu. That's cune.edu.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with Dr. Joseph Hurl, Professor of Music at Concordia University, Nebraska, about the music of Bach in his own lifetime and how that has evolved over time to influence the church music that we have today. And you mentioned this revival of Bach's music thanks to Felix Mendelssohn. I love hearing that story. It's so interesting. And it also, that wasn't that long ago in the history of all things music. The revival of Bach's music really wasn't all that long ago, which kind of blows my mind a little bit. Tell us a little bit more about, after people kind of rediscovered Bach's music, what then happened with his music in the last, 200 or so years?
Well, the first thing after the St. Matthew Passion concert in 1829 was to figure out where Bach's music was and how much of it there was. Because, as you recall, most of it had not been published during his lifetime. And so people had to locate it, they had to edit it, and they published it. And so the Bach Society was formed for that purpose, in German, Bach Gesellschaft. And over the next several decades, they published all the works of Bach that they could find. And so once those were published, people were able to issue performing editions of the works, and they started to be performed.
As a professor of music, you're involved in church music all the time. From your perspective, where do you see the influence of Bach in today's church music, particularly for the Lutheran Church?
Okay, when you think of Bach's influence, let me turn the question back on you. When you think of Bach's influence, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Hymns.
The hymns that we singing specific settings. I think of hymns in church. I always like singing Bach's hymns.
Yeah, that's very interesting because as far as we know, Bach wrote very few hymn tunes.
Right.
And we know only of a handful that he probably wrote. Those are not certain. And none of them are in our Lutheran service book. Unless you count the tune Potsdam. Which he did not write as a hymn tune, but it was arranged from the contrapuntal lines of one of his instrumental pieces by a later editor who looked at that and said, hey, this would make a decent tune. I'll just pick some parts out from it and put them all together and make a tune. So that's really the only one. As far as his musical settings, that is harmonizations of the tunes, we have very, very few that are in use. And some of them that are in use aren't, well, let's think about his setting of A Mighty Fortress is Our God that's in our hymnal. That uses the equal note version of the tune. Now, when Martin Luther wrote the tune, he wrote it in kind of a jazzy way. A mighty fortress is our God, a trusty shield and weapon. But over the course of the 16th and 17th centuries, before the organ accompaniment of hymns started, these hymns were sung by congregations in unison, sometimes as part of a choral setting, but generally in unison in these big cavernous churches with a lot of reverberation. And over the generations, the tempos slowed way down. So by the time you got into the late 17th century, it might have gone as fast as Na mighty. So, okay, that's pretty slow. Yeah. And so with a tempo like that, there's no room for any sort of rhythmic subtlety. The jazzy rhythms of Luther had been lost. And it's these slow, ponderous versions that Bach inherited. So that's why there are two versions of A Mighty Fortress in our hymnal with two different rhythms. Well, anyway, that setting by Bach of A Mighty Fortress in our hymnal, turns out it's credited to Bach in the hymnal, but as it turns out, it's not really by Bach at all.
What?
Yeah, that setting dates from the early 20th century.
Oh, no.
So when you talk about Bach's influence as far as hymns, on present-day church music, I would have to say that it is almost non-existent.
That is so fascinating. Because I think, we'll see, and I think part of it is because I sing in a Bach choir as well, and there's so many hymn tunes that we sing in chorales, but you're right, that goes the other direction. He's taking hymn tunes from other people and pulling them into his cantatas. Is that maybe why I'm associating those things?
Yeah, I think so. But so besides hymns, what else do you think of as Bach's influence today?
Yeah, there's a lot of organ music. I think we probably hear organ music far more than maybe we even realize. I could be wrong, but like organ preludes and postludes and things.
The organ music probably is where Bach's greatest influence today lies. But what's really interesting is that for most of his career, his 27, 28 years in Leipzig, Bach was not the church organist. He was cantor, which is a teacher in the school, and music director for the city of Leipzig. But in that position, his job in the church was to write compositions for the church and to direct the choir. He had two other people who played the organ during his tenure there. He had been an organist earlier in his career, and it's the earlier years where we get most of Bach's surviving organ music. Music such as the little organ book, the so-called Orgelbüchlein, which contains Bach's settings of hymns that are fancied up and interpreted by the organ. Those are certainly played a lot today. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I can see that. A lot of what Bach did on the organ, though, he simply improvised. There are reports, his first biographer, Nicholas Forkel, tells the story. He said Bach would frequently, people would visit Bach and ask him to play the organ. And so he'd sit down at the organ, pick out a theme, just kind of play something at random, and then spend the next 2 hours improvising on the theme.
Oh, wow.
So... That's what his organ playing was like a lot.
Do you think how Bach used music in worship as cantor in his time, do you think that has had any influence on how we conduct our services today?
Well, Bach's major influence as cantor was, at least in church music, was his cantatas. When was the last time you heard a cantata performed in one of our church services?
Ooh, a full one in a regular Sunday morning? I don't know.
Right.
In special worship services, yes, but that's specifically yes. because we're singing the cantata.
Right. Season, yes, for like feasts or yeah. Specific seasons, but not every Sunday.
Yeah, not every Sunday. Yeah.
So when you talk about Bach's choral music, I don't see a whole lot of influence from Bach there on today's services. Of course, you know, a choir may sing an occasional hymn setting by Bach, but we certainly don't do it the way they did it then. Oh, by the way, one more influence about his organ music that I should probably mention. When he was a young man, he might not even have been 20 years old yet. He was organist in the town of Arnstadt, and the town council was not terribly happy with his organ playing because he would put so many he would decorate the hymn tune so greatly that the congregation couldn't figure out what tune it was supposed to be. And so one thing Bach did that organists still do occasionally today is confuse the congregation with how they play.
There you go. There's a legacy.
Now, eventually, he seems to have grown out of that, but that is something.
Oh,
can I tell you something else that Bach did with the organ?
Yes.
Okay. At the time, it was common, well, maybe not so common, but one thing that Bach was known to do is play interludes between lines of a hymn. Now, okay. So let's take A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. They sing, A mighty fortress is our God. And then the organ breaks into an interlude of a few seconds with some scale passages or something else. And then they sing the next line, and that is done after every line of a hymn for all the verses. Bach is one of the first people known to have done that, and we know that he probably did because some of his music contains passages of that sort. A little while later, that practice was exported to England, and so it became common in England. Not every church in Germany or in England adopted it, but a number did, and that gradually fell out of use in the early 19th century. But for about 100 years there, it was the practice, at least in some places, to do these organ interludes between every line of a hymn.
That is interesting. I know we've sung choral pieces like that with some arrangements. That is interesting. How does the music of Bach influence or show up, I suppose, when you're teaching students now about church music, about how to conduct a service, thinking through what music looks like in a service? Are there ways that Bach shows up in that kind of teaching for your students?
Bach did his very best to interpret the meaning of the text through his music. Sometimes this was just an overall setting of the mood. Sometimes it was specific devices that we call musical rhetoric. For example, in his organ setting of the hymn in Through the Fall of... what is that? Durch Adams Fall ist ganz verderbt. What do we call that in English? Loosely translated, it's Through the Fall of Adam, Everything Has Gone Down the Toilet. Anyway, through his in his organ setting of that hymn, he has in the pedal these large descending and irregular leaps. And so those leaps depict the fall of Adam. Mm. That sort of thing. He does the same sort of thing in his vocal music. I can give you numerous instances in his cantatas where this happens. His cantata, Wachet auf, Wake Awake for Night is Flying, for the last Sunday in the church year, is amazing in this regard. In fact, there are some of the text depicts the intimate relationship between the soul and Christ, which is depicted as the relationship between a bridegroom and his bride. And some of Bach's musical interpretation of that sort of relationship, well, let me just say that, you know, you might need to be 21 or older to listen to that.
Mm-hmm. All mankind fell in Adam's fall. I think that's the one. That's the one we're thinking about.
Yes, you were pulling it from your brain.
Okay, that's it. Okay.
Like grabbing.
All right.
Well,
there we go. Yeah, not him and our hymnal.
Yeah, that's it.
Dr. Hurl, this has been great. I know we could talk for a long time about this. It's been really fun having you on Bach Week to talk about Bach's influence in our modern day church music. Dr. Joseph Hurl, professor of music at Concordia University, Nebraska. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Andy and Sarah, thanks so much. This is always fun for me.
You've been listening to Bach Week on the Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
The Coffee Hour is a production of KFUO. This program and our station are dependent on listeners just like you. To support KFUO Radio, our podcast, and all the other programming, please make your gift or pledge today at kfuo.org/give and help us continue sharing the good news of Christ for you anytime, anywhere. kfuo.org/give.